I'd like to introduce Krishnadas Kavirajdas, Christian Kussner, who is currently a part-time doctoral student at the Department of Theology and Religious Studies of Leeds University in the UK. His research is funded by the Subject Center for Philosophical and Religious Studies of the Higher Education Academy. He has previously studied at the University of California at Berkeley in the USA and Friedrich Schiller University in Jena, Germany, where he earned a master's in philosophy. He has been holding a teaching position in language and cultural education at Bauhaus University, Weimar, Germany, I'm sorry, I can't pronounce any of these things, for the last 7 years. And he's going to be speaking on interfaith dialogue. Hare Krishna.
That loud?
I can turn it up as well, that's fine. Are you okay with that?
I don't know.
Well,
I mean, the main thing is something out, right? Does something come out?
Okay.
Arch, no?
Yeah.
No? Okay, okay, I put this Kaju in here just for Tatavit Prabhu because I know he likes The New Yorker and I like it. This relates to my presentation in some way, and perhaps we have a little quiz afterwards, and you can tell me how. Okay. What I'm going to talk about today is basically a short, abbreviated, abstract version of my PhD project, and that is on interfaith dialogue in higher education. As Omila Prabhu already said, I'm doing this at the University of Leeds in the Department of Theology and Religious Studies, and with the help of a scholarship by the Subject Center, which is interesting perhaps to this Sangha here because I found out about it and applied for it after reading about it on the vast mailing list where it was forwarded to by Charanarinu Prabhu. So in a very material sense, my PhD project wouldn't be possible if it wasn't for this Sangha. And because of the funding context, and that's why the funding is mentioned as well, my project is both theoretical and practical. Not only am I doing research as part of the PhD project and assess current interfaith dialogue practice, but also I am to develop an interfaith dialogue program and the material needed for it. Of course, after developing it, there has to be a trial, and this too is part of my PhD thesis. So I ran a test run of the program I developed using the material I designed with 40 students from Leeds University, and I collected data on how it was going and how people were experiencing it and while it ran and also afterwards. And, so I did all this, and that's what I'm going to talk about today to you. My talk is going to be in four parts. First, I'm going to talk about some theoretical considerations I engaged in while studying the interfaith dialogue scene, as it were, and there really is one. These theoretical considerations would provide a rationale for the interfaith program which I designed and conducted, and which I called Walk in My Shoes, hence the name. In the second part, I want to explain the program, how it was set up, and what the procedures were. Sure. And thirdly, I want to talk about the results of the program, the feedback I got from students, and then finally, I want to make some remarks as to how I see the value of the program, where I see the value of the program, and what it could perhaps achieve. And so what it is that interfaith dialogue, at least in this specific setting, is perhaps able to achieve and could possibly aim at. I was also asked, of course, as a prerequisite of speaking at this conference, to reflect on the relevance of all this to ISKCON.
And I first thought, yeah, that's fantastic. You know, there's plenty of relevance. And then when I thought more deeply, I wasn't so sure anymore, actually. And so perhaps that can be something that you can help with. Many of you know this one much better than I do. And so maybe you can help me think about what the relevance of this is first. So first, theoretical considerations. I would like to ask the question, what is interfaith dialogue? Well, the term interfaith dialogue is used for a range of discourses that take place in a variety of settings and with different goals. It's usually seen as a desirable but problematic encounter, the problem being the different and often conflicting truth claims of different religions. And therefore, in the literature, the issue of truth is fairly dominant. And it seems to play a large role in the context of the broader interfaith movement that has come to be called, or as it has come to call itself, rather. But it is true. But is truth really this important, or important in this way in interfaith dialogue? And how does it really impact on the situation of interfaith communication? And thinking about the situation and what goes on in situations of communication in general, I find it useful to think about the purpose of these instances of communication, what ends people want to meet by communicating. And of course, these are manifold, and so interfaith dialogue is also manifold, but as a general set of categories, I think Maslow's description of human needs might serve as well.
Can I perhaps move this a little bit? So I don't always have to move away from the microphone. Yeah.
Okay. So, one instance, for instance, if you think of communication where truth is definitely not central is politeness, isn't it? The point of being polite is exactly not to tell the truth. So obviously there must be instances of communication where truth, in particular religious truth, even between practitioners of different traditions, do not play a role. Maslow's hierarchy of needs starts at the base level, the physiological needs. And, you know, for a religion, there might be a dialogue about these physiological needs that, say, in terms of, you know, paper being allocated to print books, or being able to open temples, you know, these fairly material things. And religion might talk, you know, to another, to the state or that's dominated or intertwined with another religion, and that's a sort of interfaith dialogue that has nothing to do with religious truth. Next, Maslow mentions safety needs. Well, there's also a discourse, I suppose, going on between this, like people, different religions, representatives of different religions, guarding sort of their resources. Belonging needs. How that's a negotiation, perhaps, how an institution sees its role in the state. Maybe one that's between belonging needs, safety needs, is also to be able to teach religious education in state schools. Yeah? And different religions might collaborate on a piece of legal proposition or so in order to get this right established in a certain country. And again, they're talking with each other. They have a common interest they pursue, but truth is not part of it. Then esteem needs. People, you know, need to feel respect for themselves. And a lot of interfaith dialogue, and I dare say a lot of interfaith dialogue that is kind of interesting, has to do not with religious truth, but with esteem. If you are part of an interfaith dialogue council, that means you're religious, right? And so, you know, trying to be part of the interfaith dialogue council, that might get you recognized as a religion in a certain state. In the UK, the Hare Krishna movement usually has no problem being recognized as a religion, but that's different, for instance, for pagans. Yeah, pagans are trying now to get onto these interfaith councils that are established in many UK cities because they consider themselves a faith. but they're not usually successful. And then there are finally cognitive needs, and here indeed I think truth plays a role. That's where we talk about knowledge, it's about what is right, what is not right. So here indeed, truth is an issue. Maslow has also the category of self-actualization needs, and I just leave this out here because it's a pretty or fairly difficult and contested concept. I think it might maybe made useful, but it needs a lot of work, and we don't really have time for this here, and there's no need also. So truth is at the cognitive level. But there's but in a sense, if you look at this, esteem needs also has a kind of truth, isn't it? If I show someone respect, then that's kind of it's a kind of the truth of this sort of discourse, isn't it? Or safety needs. If I'm protected, if this dialogue, this discourse serves my self-preservance, yeah. Then if that is achieved, if someone sort of lets me be, then that is also the truth of this, discourse. And I think these different notions all play a role when people of different religions come in contact with each other. One famous example of someone being puzzled by all this is, I don't know how to pronounce this in English, I'm afraid, Pontius Pilatus. Remember? He wants to free Jesus, and the crowd demands to be hanged. And then he asks Jesus, and he says, "Well, I'm speaking the truth." And then Pilatus, Pontius Pilatus, okay.
Pilate.
Like the pilot, yeah. Okay. That makes sense. Pontius Pilate, he asks, back, "What is truth? Like, what in this situation is truth? Are we talking about religious truth? Are we talking about safety? Like, what is it at stake here?" So, I think it is fairly clear that divergent truth claims are only a problem in the sense that's discussed in the theological literature of, contesting religious truth in a very specific sort of dialogue, and in many other contexts, it is not. And so, solving these divergent truth claims into a pluralistic theology, how it is usually done, is neither necessary nor successful. For a lot of the goals that interfaith dialogue pursues, like good relationships and communities and so on. Now, my own academic background is philosophy, and from the beginning, actually, I wanted to explore how philosophical interfaith dialogue would be possible. In a way, what I'm trying to do is to bridge the gap between the theological discourse, where people come up with all kinds of pluralistic theologies and how truth can be reconciled or not, even with what's going on in regular people's life. I'm looking at students in universities, but this might apply to any sort of lay people who are not theologians or not religious experts. In the discourse of the theologians, you really don't see much of the day-to-day religious lives and encounters of interreligious encounters of people on the ground doesn't reflect in the theological discourse, and vice versa, the theological discourse that does take place doesn't really seem to impact communities or lay people. So I wanted to do this. I wanted to think, I think that it's important that this theology sort of be made relevant to people in everyday situations, and the idea was how can want to facilitate this, and that's the idea behind philosophical interfaith dialogue. So by philosophical, I mean the discussed questions of validity. So yes, we're back about questions about truth, even though it is a very specific kind of dialogue, by no means the only valuable one. And discussing questions of validity by rational arguments. Again, this rational argument, this rational argument and rational discourse doesn't mean, on the one hand, in this ideological sense, rationalism doesn't mean in a specific philosophical technical sense. It just means that people are reasoning about their beliefs and how they apply to their lives. Anyways, what this implies is a move away from the often rather shallow mutual assurances of we are okay, you are okay, we're all fine, that are not uncommon in interfaith dialogue practice, and that's what the quote at the beginning from Pepsi you know, was supposed to signify. And what Jan Olaf would definitely call the political correctness agenda that's pervading interfaith dialogue. Now, I think what systematically two basic scenarios are possible of doing rational, philosophical interfaith dialogue defined first. I don't want to lay them out in a purely systematic fashion, but instead I want to present them to you using historical examples. During my research, I was amazed to discover that both prototypical models, I'm just going to talk about in a minute, were articulated and exemplified right from when the issue of religious plurality, to which the interfaith dialogue movement is the response, first manifested, namely right from the 16th century. Well, the first one is Erasmus of Rotterdam's discourse with Martin Luther about freedom of will. This is now available to us in the form of a book. These essays have been collected, and they've usually originally been a series of public letters going back and forth between them. As you know, Martin Luther was a Protestant, and Erasmus was a humanist Catholic, you could say. And they conversed about the topic of the freedom of the will. Now, Erasmus' conception was, well, there are certain things we cannot discuss because they're just a given in Christianity. They're real truth and we have to accept them as they are. Scripture, for instance. But then, aside from these essentials, there is a lot of scope for discussion and we can't find out, and in the discussion, you know, truth will become apparent. And so that's what, how he engaged in this dialogue with Martin Luther. Now the important thing about this is that they had a shared frame of reference. What I mean by shared frame of reference is, for instance, that they had some scripture that they both referred to, that they had religious authorities that they quoted. And the shared frame of reference is more than just a common language. It really is the sort of referential framework that gives meaning to the words people use. If nobody says this is correct, this is incorrect, then this correct and incorrect is defined within the framework, right? They are working in the conceptual framework. If, for instance, Erasmus says this is right because it's in the Bible, and I say this is right because it's in the Bhagavad Gita, we both use the word right. And what we mean by it is completely different. So the frame of reference within which we are working really defines the meaning of the words and the concepts that we're using. So they both had a shared frame of reference, and their dialogue could be result-driven. They were trying to find out what the truth on the issue was. They wanted to arrive at a certain conclusion. Now, of course, there's a problem with that. You might ask, is this interfaith dialogue, if a Protestant and a Catholic are talking together about some very specific problem in Christianity? Well, maybe not, but it just goes to show how difficult it is to achieve, or maybe impossible, a common frame of reference across religious borders. Now, the second model is exemplified by Jean Baudin's book, Colloquium of the Seven about the Secrets of the Sublime. A very interesting book. It was written and finished in 1588. It was not published until 1855, I believe. And there is only one English translation available today. That's from the beginning of the 80s, I believe. It's a very interesting book. In his book, it's a fictional piece of literature. Seven people meet in a house in Venice, Italy, Venice, huh? And these seven people are a Catholic, a Lutheran, a Calvinist, a Jew, a Muslim, a deist. So somebody who's considering, like, you know, has a sort of a rational religion, you could say, sort of the forerunner of the today modern interfaith dialogue theologians in many ways, and then the skeptic. This skeptic is sometimes also called a religious studies scholar, whatever that's worth. But you get the idea, yeah? Somebody who's just asking, calling things into question. Now, they meet for 7 nights in Venice at this house, you know, over dinner. Actually recognize the Greek idea of having dinner together and discussing philosophy. And they are talking about their faiths. And they're quite explicit and aggressive, actually, about the truth of their faith. But at no point do they aim to come to a common conclusion. There's no conclusion, it's just left open. This is really puzzling the commentators as well. Usually commentators then speculate, that Buddha really means that there's one complex truth and all religions just present a facet of that. Maybe he does, but he doesn't say so, and that's an important point. Maybe that's the case. But even if it was, we wouldn't have the language to talk about this, because we come from each our own frames of references. And if we move outside of those, we wouldn't, then it wouldn't work anymore. Each of us are looking, so to speak, from the inside of our religions, to which we want to be truthful, to the other, and are able to frame our experience in our own terms, that come from our background, from our own frame of reference. And if you leave this to find a sort of common frame of reference, we do not create an umbrella, but really we create another ideology. And a lot of interfaith dialogue actually is like this nowadays. There's a kind of interspirituality, if you want, going on. And it is interesting that this problem was, for instance, even seen by a fellow named Benz, who wrote in 1933, where he's saying that to engage in a meta-dialogue, like above, in order to connect the religions, it means to sacrifice the religious ethic for the maintenance of the public order. He also says it means that the participants in dialogue have become mere theoreticians of their religion, but are practitioners of the civil ethic and timid supporters of the tranquillitas publica, public body. I didn't read Buddha in this way, but his arguments are valid. It's an interesting analysis of the interfaith dialogue movement today, I think. The problem usually people have with this performance-oriented dialogue that doesn't see the result is that it kind of seems pointless, isn't it? Why are we even doing it? And people who seem to support this are people who actually, in a hidden way, perhaps, think, well, it's not really necessary that we agree, because and now comes in something that's also taking its birth around that time, because of the argument from conscience. Well, the argument of conscience goes something like this. If you sincerely worship God, your salvation is guaranteed. Even if you do it in the wrong way, you worship the wrong deity, if you do everything wrong, just by your own sincerity, your salvation, you'll be fine. So this is, of course, a theological claim. It comes from within one frame of reference. Now, the danger here is, again, if we create a separate Veda theoretical discourse, that we take this argument from conscience even further, as, for instance, was ordered, where there, sincerity does not only guarantee your salvation, but indeed guarantees the truth. If you're just really, really sincere about what you do, you cannot possibly be mistaken. Now, that's really dangerous for a society, different people of different religions, isn't it? Because if ardent belief and faith is taken to the sole criteria of truth, we get people who fly airplanes into World Trade Centers and stuff like this. So it becomes a very individualistic, internalized criteria that needs to be, I think, in order for there to be a balanced objective findings of what people need to be held accountable to their beliefs in some way. So, after having pointed out the difficulties with creating a meta-narrative, the problematic issues, now how do we get around it in doing it in dialogue? How can we avoid creating this meta-narrative? Well, my suggestion is we have to adhere to the Schoenberg kind of dialogue, performance-oriented, not the self-oriented. But at no point can we sort of assume that truth is really a matter of no concern, because it is important. Now, my suggestion would be that instead of the PowerPoint presentation. Sorry. The idea is that what is this truth? Let's take a closer look at truth, religious truth. If we, for instance, say there are 50 chairs in this room, right? Well, how is this claim made reasonable? Well, we just go around. We know how to do this and count the chairs, and we know whether the 50 chairs in this room is a true sentence or not. Well, if I say, and that's sort of a frame of reference we share, right? But if I say Krishna is blue, that doesn't work in the same way. You can't verify that statement in the same way. Even among devotees, you can't. So how do we then verify this claim? Well, we talk not about truth, actually, but about truth criteria. And one important truth criteria is, for instance, coherence. Right? Well, it says in the Bhagavad Gita, if it's coherent with what it says in the Bhagavad Gita or the Bhagavad Gita, then it's true. Another truth criteria would be plausibility. That's actually a very strong one, isn't it? Possibility. It's stronger, for instance, than physical impossibility. We have no problems with believing that Jesus walked on water. I never met a religious person who had any disputes with that. But if I was telling the story that Jesus, you know, was asked by the sick man to heal him, and he said, well, get away, bastard, and he kicked him in the ass, which I can't believe. Because physically it's totally possible, but it's very implausible. It doesn't make sense. Right? That's a very strong criteria. Authority. Here we're talking about frame of references that might be difficult to bridge. But authority is also acquired in discourse through integrity. Right? So if somebody is really has a lot of integrity, I think if we look at the stories of how we came to Krishna consciousness, I think there will always be a person with a lot of integrity that just did it for us. Maybe that was Prabhupada, but maybe that was also another devotee. I said, yeah, this person, you know, he's so honest and sincere and upright, and he just can't be talking nonsense. You know, there must be something to it. And of course, there's also the criteria of what works for people. Now, I'm not suggesting that we need to change the conception of truth. This is sometimes, for instance, said about the pragmatists. You know, that for them, truth is everything that works. But actually, even the pragmatists didn't say that. Their conception of truth was still, truth is what corresponds to fact. But only how do we know what corresponds to fact? Well, an indication is plausibility, or worse, integrity, coherence, authority. So the idea is that we, in the Interfaith Dialogue program I was supposed to develop, I wanted to focus on these criteria rather than on the truths of the religions themselves. So, so far for the theoretical considerations and the rationale of the Walk in My Shoes program, I'm now going to introduce the program as I set it up, and perhaps it's up to you to judge how much it reflects the theoretical considerations that I just told you about. So I started advertising the program about 3 weeks before it was to start. I used posters and PR flyers at various locations around the university, foremost of all the student union, and actually by successful people in getting the message out and stuff. I was told the secret: not sure how that is applicable and relevant for ISKCON, but the best way to get people to read your flyer is if you put them inside toilet doors. Public toilets. I work. The chaplaincy also helped and made it known through their communication channels. I talked to the heads of the religious student societies at the student union, and I was able to get a positive response from them, and then they advertised it through their mailing lists in turn. I also put out flyers in the theology and religious studies department, and a couple of people from there joined as well. Now, one important consideration in doing this for me was I never ever mentioned the word interfaith dialogue. This had to do with the fact that interfaith dialogue is now so much part of the political correctness agenda that people who are truly religious just start rolling their eyes if they hear the term. But these were the people I wanted to get. So I didn't call it interfaith dialogue at all. Throughout the program, there was no mention of interfaith, the word didn't occur. This is, for instance, one of these tear-off flyers, for inside public toilet doors. The program started with a gathering where I explained the rationale of it and how it would work, and then people talked to each other over food and found in a sort of semi-natural way a conversation partner they would work with for the following 2 months. The core idea of the program was, in the setup, that I would have conversation partners in pairs of two. So we're not having religions talking to each other, and what is that anyway? But we have religious people talking to each other. None of which was really expected or could be expected from the sheer setup of the program to be representing the fullness or to speak of the teachings of their religions. So again, we're not talking about truth, but we're talking about truth criteria. There were also some people who couldn't come to the initial meeting, and I paired them up on the basis of the interest in a specific religion that they had expressed. So if somebody said, well, I want to talk to a Jew, and I saw whether I had a Jew on my list that I could pair them up with. The program consisted of two parts. The first were the tandem meetings I just talked about, where people met in pairs of two. For them, I prepared a topic sheet booklet, as I called it. I have one here, for instance. It's a black and white copy version. Colors are expensive. And there are 12 topic sheets in there with for the different topics. Now, notice these topics, again, are not about religious truths, but they're like topics that are, I thought, important in a person's religious life. So each of these...
Hold on. I'll show you later.
Then the second part were private blogs. I set up on the internet free private blogs. Google Mail has an easy facility to do that. Where people were asked to write one blog entry that only they and I could see after each meeting. This, it turned out, was very difficult for people to do. They weren't really sure what they wanted to go into, what they should write. And I wasn't really sure what to tell them to write about, because I wanted to be open and see just what emerges, what kind of things do come up. And I didn't want to guide it too much by questions. Anyways, the private blogs is probably a part that I would have included in another one, but it was there for me to gain material to analyze in the end.
I can also, perhaps if you want to have a look, pass this round. Got another booklet here. I also have a color version.
This is how such a topic sheet would look like. I picked here one that's called Why Do Bad Things Happen to Good People? There's an introductory paragraph why explain what the topic is about, what it, why it is significant, and then there's a list of questions that people are asked to consider, perhaps in preparation or also in the conversation themselves. In this specific topic sheet, I found the story of this woman whose husband died in the World Trade Center attacks, And she, in this little paragraph next to the picture, narrates how she was praying for her husband's life in front of the TV, but then when he died anyway, she lost her faith. And the task here is, imagine this woman to be a member of your community. How would you talk to this woman? How would you encourage her not to lose faith? How would you console her, perhaps? So again, it's a situation, and it's not a doctrine. Another very popular one was talking to God. Here, for instance, some of the questions were, what is, how do you communicate with God? How do you know He answers? How do you interpret signs, perhaps? How can you be so sure they're really on from God? Is there miscommunication? Have you experienced moments of silence? Things like this. Another really popular one was death and immortality. In the preparation of this program, I was part of a similar research project. Why I tried to do this too, and the people rejected it. Again, here's the political correctness agenda coming in. You say, no, you can't do this. The topic of death is much too sensitive for students. Don't use it in the title, please. And then it was called Mortality and Immortality. They changed it to Mortality and Immortality. But then at the end of the project, it was just deleted without even letting me know. Now, when I said, no, I need to include this in my own program. And I did. And it turned out to be one of the three most successful topics. People really want to talk about this. So there's no need to be politically correct or like superficially sensitive. As the topic sheets progressed in the booklet, the topics got more personal. One of the later ones was keeping the faith, where people are asked to reflect on how they deal with doubts. Perhaps tell the person where do they doubt, maybe how do they deal with doubts, are there strategies, who do they talk to, how much can you doubt before you lost your religion, questions like this. Now this is what such a block would look like that I created, and then the people who were a member of this block, except myself, only one person each would write their book entries. Now, as to the results. The results I'm going to present stem from the block entries the participants wrote and from the focus groups I held at the end of the program. Also, I asked participants to fill in a form after the program. So besides the form, just in mere prose, from the interviews and the blog entries, there are about 160,000 words to analyze, which is quite a chunk to consider that a PhD thesis is usually about 100,000 words in itself. So the results I present here, I'm quite confident about that these are really the things that happen in these conversations. Just as you don't think like the half of them Catholics and one half of them Protestants, no, we had 49 participants, 9 dropped out, 40 completed the program, the gender ratio fairly evenly distributed, and the religious backgrounds of people were, we had 18 Christians, and the next biggest section was Muslims, 8, Hindu, Jewish, we had 6, the Baha'i, atheists, and an agnostic. They came up out of their own account. I didn't invite them. I wasn't sure I wanted them, but it turned out it was good that they were there. The Christian group in itself is quite diverse itself. Out of these 18, there were 5 Mormons, 3 Anglicans, 1 Catholic, an Evangelical Baptist. That's really cool. You get an Evangelical Baptist to be part of interfaith dialogue. That's an achievement. And one person called him the post-evangelical. Also interesting. So these are all self-designations I have here. And, I didn't give any categories. So first, some feedback on the setup of the program. The tandem, pairs and so on. It works for people, and they appreciated that the fact that it couldn't be hijacked, in their words, by politics. So one Jewish girl, for instance, said, I think, for me personally, often particularly between Jewish people and Muslim people, often it gets hijacked by politics, and in this instance it wasn't allowed to be hijacked by politics, because that wasn't in any way a shame, and because it was just the two people who were there, who were only interested in religion, it was solely focused on that, and that was really important to me. Actually, it was quite, it made a nice, like, nice change, really, that it was really solely on religion. Again, in advance, by people of the chaplaincy, I was warned again making pairs between Jewish and Muslims. There have been sort of an unrest, like an intellectual unrest at least, at Queen's University about Palestina and Israel relationships. And so I went ahead and did it anyway. And these two pairs were really successful. People really enjoyed it. So this girl talked to a Muslim, for instance. The other quote here on this slide is, I think often when you discuss religion, you talk about principles, whereas here you talk about how you actually apply that in your life and how you live it or struggle with it or whatever, which is really good. Another thing that came up again and again in the interviews, but people appreciated that they could get deep fast. So one person said here, I thought it was really great, the level of life, the level of the discussion in terms of discussions that deep you normally don't have, except with your best friends. And to meet somebody and straight off be that deep within a conversation on a human level, and how you relate to things in human life, and having different perspectives on things, and how you accept it, how you relate to things, I thought it was just mind-blowing. And just to think about not having to go through the whole process of getting to know a person, but just being able to go straight in there, that was nice. Interesting. Now, something I didn't expect. Actually, there was two girls, a Muslim girl, sort of a little bit struggling with her faith, and a Baha'i girl, very firm in her faith. And they both told me afterwards that in the second meeting they had in the country, they suddenly started, without realizing it at first, talking about how both of them lost their virginity. Well, that's not what I intended. In Bengala, but here you go. People really, perhaps it's not even that they just sort of saved themselves the trouble of getting to become someone's really good friend before you talk about these things. But perhaps precisely because you didn't know that person that well in your other sort of social life. You were able to engage in this almost therapeutic conversation, for some people. Another result was finding inspiration through and community with the other. And I read the quote again. The thing that gives you confidence is the fact that you know there are other people out there. They're living in, they've got faith as well, and so that you are not alone. And so that gives you confidence to think about it. The second quote says, I think it was just nice to find someone that had similar values to me, and it's reassuring to know that other people believe in God or whatever. Because I don't have many friends who are religious, so it's nice to have someone of a similar age to me and that that has similar ideas to me. And then the third one, perhaps most concise, everyone struggles with their faith, and it was nice to understand other people's struggles as well. So, now, really interesting, something I didn't expect, was people actually appreciated the fact that they could talk to someone from another religion about their faith rather than to someone of their own faith community, because it meant not being judged by the standards of your own. Here it says, and it is really refreshing to be able to say what you felt about your faith to somebody of another faith, because you knew that that person wouldn't judge you on your practices. Or the second quote says, I would be judged finally for the way I handled my own religion, and there it be understood that I was the person of faith instead of the person representing faith. So, maybe here's a point of relevance for Islam. Young people trying to own their faith, moving from a situation of having inherited their faith to a situation of owning their faith, you know, have to make these negotiations, and it's sometimes, as Prabhupada said, sometimes you need a grandmother, not a father. And somebody who just listens and doesn't judge. And that can be someone from, surprisingly, another religious tradition. And again, I'd like to stress, you know, we're not talking about a Christian converting a Muslim or teaching them like the prospects and trying to convince them about truth. So another result was learning about oneself and one's own faith. This person says, for me, it was also the chance to understand more how what I believe and to actually realize and think about it like more logical. No, I wouldn't say logical, but in a more like realized fashion, what I actually believe, rather than just doing things and not really thinking about it. You notice I left it in the way I spoke, so it's a little weird when I read it, I suppose. Maybe I should smooth through that for this presentation. So here again is the element of negotiation, your own religious identity. There's many more quotes like this, but I think this one captures it really well. Another result that people kept telling me about was they learned to express themselves. One participant said, the clarity of the language, because of a lot of the ideas that came up in the topic sheets, were ones that within the context of in my faith community, I would be very familiar with. These aren't terribly new ideas. The concept of life after death and why do bad things happen to good people. What was interesting was then to go, now, can I take that concept and remove any of the jargon from it, remove any of the words that I would expect to be able to put it in, because the person I was talking to might have heard them before. So like the clarity of the language that came out was just lovely, and the clarity that I got to receive was equally lovely. I think that's a point that's important in preaching. Like a lot of times we have our jargon and push it on people, you know, and do they really understand? And then finally, learning from one another. Now that's dangerous, because now we're talking about, apparently about truth, and I said I wanted to avoid this. But still, there was some learning from one another, but it was actually not about religious truth, but about, well, here in this setting I can use the word, that's nice, hermeneutical strategies. Well, so interpreting the religious teachings, or interpreting your life and things that happen to you, and things you experience in terms of your own faith, and how to make sense of it. These strategies actually, in some cases, seemed to be transferable. And people actually learn in this way. Let me read you the first quote. I found that while discussing these things with my partner, I found she's actually really faithful to her religion, and I've been sort of loosey-goosey for the past 1 year or so. So talking to her, realizing that she's having probably even bigger problems compared to me, and whining in my situation, such small problems and everything, puts everything into perspective and challenged me to push my faith to new levels. Okay, that's not a good search, sorry, but we'll get to that. Actually, the person saying this was a Christian from Malaysia, and the person he was talking to, who was admiring for their strictness, for all the rules, all the praying, was a hard Christian. So, good for us. Well done. Second quote. I definitely say so that I did learn some things from her, because mainly mental posture, that's an interesting word, isn't it? About how we deal with life in difficult situations especially, because she seems to follow a lot of rules. So definitely I learned something from her about how to keep a few rules as well as praying for extended periods of time. She seems to have got it down perfectly. So again, it's not about him becoming a Hare Krishna or anything. It's his own spiritual practice. So there's no transgression from one frame of reference to the other. And the third one, my partner talked a bit about practicing the presence of God. That was not quite the words he used for it, but those are the words my husband would use for it. And I think it helped me to make sense of what he's on about for the first time. So there's like a lady who's married, and the two Christians, and apparently they had their arguments among each other. And talking to someone else, she finally understood what her husband was on about. Someone from another religion. Performing identity. I'm not sure about this phrasing, but I couldn't think of any better. Another thing that struck me from the focus group was that people seem to enjoy the activity of meeting up and talking about these issues as a religious act in itself. There is a real sense of performing identity, not just figuring it out. Of course, it's a pretty abstract concept, and people are unlikely to put it in these words directly, but it was there in the subtext of the group conversations during focus groups. I picked out two quotes here from longer sequences in which this element of performing identity seemed particularly strong. Maybe you'll do it, but just do it first. The other thing which I really got a lot out of this experience was kind of expansion of what counts as a faith community. And in my pair, I got to a point where we didn't think ourselves necessarily as belonging to our individual faiths, but felt more we actually constituted our own faith community, the two of us, if that makes sense. Well, again, that sounds problematic in light of what I just said before, but really what is taking place here is the different categories that map onto faith communities sort of take precedence in bonding. In this case, we're both participants. We're bonding on the distance they themselves maintain to the religious institutions they belong to. Okay? Cultivated, I'd say, a rather ironic relationship with a religious institution. And that really made them click. Yeah. So the fourth part, remarks on the value of the Walk in My Shoes program. Well, what I've tried to do with this interfaith dialogue program, the whole PhD thesis, is not coming to interfaith dialogue with any sort of preconceived notion of what the result should be. I wanted to look philosophically, what is possible? What can be done with integrity without compromising anyone's position? And then build the program on these principles and just see what comes out. And what, you know, so these are the results we just heard. And these are things, I think, that interfaith dialogue can aim at without subscribing to any political reference agenda. You know? So now, that's of course a value, but now how do we put this together? I'm tempted to use the concept of maturity. Maturity, just from the program itself, I think would mean that if people after the program were more able to see that the other person is coming from a different frame of reference and that we have to listen kind of to the story and can get something out of this conversation without having to agree on anything. Yeah? This tolerance for ambiguity, that's a sign of maturity. I also looked this up in literature on the spiritual maturity. There is some, not much, but this sort of identification and negotiation against the background of transcendent categories is there mainly in psychological accounts. For instance, the authors Jan Eisenbrand and Miller, in the 2000 volume called The Psychology of Mature Spirituality. And now my printout leaves me, but I know it was just before this started. They describe maturity in terms of integrity, wisdom, and transcendence. So according to them, integrity refers to both the ability to integrate diverse states and an ethical commitment, and wisdom, the ability to apply categories to reality and be aware of mismatches. I think that sounds very reasonable. And transcendence finally refers to some sort of going beyond, expanding one's consciousness, or overcoming one's limitations. Maybe we don't need that in our concept of maturity. A Lovinger might provide another clue, her theory of levels of ego development, the highest of which is again called integrated, which refers to the capacity to pull together multiple meanings with a tolerance for ambiguity and paradox. Fowler, in the tradition of, and now I don't know if I pronounce this correct, Piaget and Courbet, developed a model of six stages of faith development, and the fifth stage is called conjunctive, and again shows tolerance of ambiguity and paradox. He also has a sixth stage called universalizing, but it's kind of problematic and there's very little empirical evidence. A more straightforward philosophical and theological account of spiritual maturity comes from Lowry in his 2007 book, Maturity of Belief, Critically Assessing Religious Faith. And he defines mature faith as one recognizing the complexities of issues and its own fallibility and limitations in the face of it. The ability to change and adapt and new insights become available, the confidence not to require confirmation from others and tolerance of other opinions. In all these accounts, it seems that maturity has to do with being able to recognize reality for what it is, even if it's not entirely comprehensible in terms of one's faith categories, as well as in the resultant tolerance for ambiguity, which is grounded in a secure sense of self. It's interesting now to think about this concept of maturity, what that means for religious pluralists, right, who really seem to need non-ambiguity. Yeah, and that everything has to be one truth, and we all have all to agree. That's actually perhaps a rather neophyte perception of the situation. So, maybe I'll just leave it at that. There's also considerations of people when they talk about their own faith, that sort of this the creation of this career and self-narrative benefits them in their psychological development. I'm not sure where to go to this. So now for the relevance of ISKCON. Well, two thoughts perhaps just maybe to trigger some responses from you. I think this difference between the dominant discourse, the official theological discourse, and what goes on in people's lives, I mean, there's some bridging to do as well. And not sure how this could be facilitated, but in general, a program like this could work with people from the same religion as well. There is no news when I say, and this has been discussed like a long time in ISKCON, that you have a society a community of people with very high moral standards, but no differentiation except black and white. And you're bound to get a lot of hypocrisy. People don't have a language to admit to fall downs or to lower standards without being, you know, feeling excluded from the society. But I'm not sure how this particular program really relates to this. Okay, well.
Just practical questions, or a question on your procedure. You had these, I think it was 12 sheets.
Yeah.
So each group would meet presumably altogether 12 times. And
no, 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 no.
How did that work?
Yeah, I should have mentioned that, thank you. I asked them to meet 4 or 5 times. That was the requirement. First of all, it's difficult to get students to do something like this on the side, on top of their curricular credits.
You know, that's more than a question.
I have another answer to that as well. Also the idea was that there's some choice, right? So if you have 12 topic sheets and people are asked to do 12 meetings, then there's no choice. The idea was, here's 12 topics, you meet 4 times, you know, just pick the ones you like. The ones that sort of speak to you, if you want. But do them in the order in which they occur in the book, because there was some progression built in. Now, the other questions, how do you get people to do this? I'm not sure, but there is actually sort of a market out there, it seems. As I was mentioning before, that I was part of a research project where I tried to implement my ideas and perhaps do my research for the PhD. And then in the end, I turned out to be not influential enough to get it done the way I thought it should be done, and that was in Sheffield. And they did an interfaith program where they also paired up people in twos, so they took that idea. But then wanted it to be a credit-earning exercise. And so people had a rigorous sort of program of like giving account of what they did talk about, what they learned, what one, you know, and that. Right. What do I want to learn the next time around? And afterwards, reflect: did I learn it? What do I need to do in order to learn it? So very rigorous, which is the other possibility. You know, that you spend can be part of their credit earning thing, and they would, you know, alleviate their other academic duties. But then they had to engage in this activity in this sort of academic way rather than in a merely, you know, conversational, personal way. And of course, the people in Sheffield, they wouldn't of course admit that this wouldn't work, and they did get people who did it and seemingly liked it. I asked the people who participated in my program whether they would have preferred it the other way, and while they recognized that it would have been good to not have as much academic workload and the program could subtract, you know, from the rest, that would be good. But at the same time, they wouldn't want to do this in this academic manner and giving account and writing, you know, strict goals and, you know, and things like that. Any?
First of all, I think it's quite wonderful what you did. And I want to thank you for doing that. I think we live in a world where intolerance is a critical problem. And I think your program, as I understand it, helps to facilitate the development of tolerance, which I think is extremely important. And I like the way that you selected a number of themes that cut across religious traditions and religious differences and allows people to hear and appreciate the humanity of the other and identify with the humanness of a person who may come from a different culture or a religious ethnic background, whatever that is. And I think one of the questions in my mind is how could the efficacy of this kind of a program be expanded? And I think that one of the big questions has to do with the nature of the people who participated. Clearly, they all wanted to do it. Mm-hmm. So they were highly self-selected. And they were interested in learning about the other, the very title of the program, Walk in My Shoes. The only people who would be interested in doing that would be people who wanted to learn about the other.
But interestingly, see, I didn't call it walk in their shoes, I called it walk in my shoes, because often intertake dialogues about listening to the other and the other and the other and the other, you know, and I want people to also know I want to.
That's a very good point. Yeah, but then, so the question arises, there is this other possible model that you mentioned of putting it into an academic context, which is not entirely coercive, but there's an element of it. And the question is, do you think there would be any way to take either this program or some elements of this program and create a successful program who were, for participants who were not necessarily, you know, entirely voluntary, and who might experience some resistance to the idea of participating in this kind of dialogue? Because it seems to me it's all well and good to approach those people who are already highly exposed towards tolerance, but it would be nice if you could sort of move the right line between tolerance and intolerant.
Well, let me first make a qualification. It's true, you know, I did get people who were interested in dialogue, but I did not only get people who were interested in dialogue. I had an evangelical Baptist there. You know, and he clearly was out to convert his office in America, yeah? And I talked about it, and that was kind of a problem. It was a little bit of a disturbance. You know, the Muslim himself, interestingly, a British convert.
Yeah.
Wow. I was really happy I made that. But he said, yeah, it was kind of a disturbance, you know, he kind of tried to preach to me here. But, you know, I'm a Muslim myself, you know, I know how these things go, I can tolerate it. So again, people have a sort of a tolerance of things. They don't, you know, people that are 20 years old, they don't need to be protected. They can handle it themselves. And so I think that with this sort of program, I didn't mention interfaith dialogue, it was about telling your story. You know, you do get people who are not so interested in dialogue, who may not be so open. On the second issue, you know, like your question, I have to say, implies a kind of political correct agenda to some degree. See, because I get asked a similar question often, actually, when I talk about my research with other people. But I always have to point out, this program is not designed to prevent terrorists from becoming terrorists. I'm not saving the world. I don't know. If you have ideas how this can be expanded to people who are less tolerant in the beginning and could pass that benefit from it, I don't know. I don't know. If you have, I'd be interested. But at the same time, you know, it's not a claim that this program seeks to fulfill. Yeah, well, no, I didn't ask them, like, were there questions of conversion, because I was having group interviews, but I was monitoring and staying in touch with each pair. I saw when the block entries came in, I could read what they were about, and I was able to contact people if their things seemed to get out of hand. With these 40 people and roughly 20 pairs, I mean, there are a little bit less than 20 pairs, because some pairs were in threes, and one in five. There were two and a half instances where people felt the other was trying to convert them. One instance was interesting enough, like from what I was trying able to figure out afterwards with the Romanian person, is that a Muslim guy fell in love with a Catholic girl and really needed her to become a Muslim in order for that relationship to happen. She wasn't into it. So he kind of dropped out. But the other two was a Muslim and a Christian, and she felt a little proselytized, and he invited her over to dinner to her house and with the family, and she was reluctant, so she had to do extensive energy to ward this off. Yeah, these things happen.
I guess related to what you mentioned, the Baptist and the Muslim group. How did the groups come to be identified? Did they find each other, or did you insert your input into that? How did that
happen? On the flyers that I distributed and the posters I put out, there was no venue when this first event would take place, the initial starting event. But there was only an email address and a Facebook group. I created a group on Facebook. That's how I learned about Facebook. Whoever registered with the Facebook group or who wrote to me that they would be interested in taking part, I sent them an email back and asked them, can you please tell me, what's your religious background? To what kind of person would you like to talk? Like, from what religious background? And have you had any experience in written clear dialogue before? These are the three questions. And then, like, the designation that presented here, the movement and so on, these were all self-designations. I didn't go back and ask, like, what kind of Muslim are you? You know, if somebody just were Muslim, that was Muslim for me. Somebody said, there's like this Shia, and like one from Iran. So they self-identified themselves as such. You know, some people said, I'm Christian, ISKCON. I took the liberty of merging them into one category. But Christians, you know, some said Mormon, some said Anglican, some said just Christian. So these are self-designations that people gave. Oh, the parents. Okay, yeah, there's two sort of possibilities, right? One is you say, well, you go with you, and the other possibility is to have people find their own partners. And what I wanted to do is avoid a decision of this and do it in a sort of a mixed way. So I explained the program at the initial event, and then I said, so now we had an icebreaker activity, you know, everyone got to learn from each other a little bit. And they said, so now in the back there's lots of food, go have some food. And then people started talking to each other. And while they were having food and talking to each other, they said, well, by the way, if you found someone you would like to work with, just come to me and tell me your names. And then if people were like in a situation where they already had found someone they found interesting, they just signaled me and they became a pair. And then, of course, in the end, there were some people left, you know, that didn't. So we were interested in looking at this guy over there. He's going to perhaps talk to him. Oh, and I was also just suggesting partnerships. I said, how are you, Erica, how about you go with, you know, a moment? And, yeah. And I guess some of the people that are dropping out, from the 9 people dropping out, were once who were perhaps dissatisfied with the kind of match they get. It's a little bit of an awkward sort of social situation. I also asked the participants afterwards what they like better. You know, being able to choose their own partner or being matched up by me. Because some came later to the program and I'll just match them up on the basis of the information they gave me. And guess what? The ones that found their partner naturally insisted that this was the best way, and the ones that got matched up insisted, no, this should be done. So I guess both were to some degree. But there's always a moment of social awkwardness that you just have to live with. Just to try it out, how it would work outside of the with people from Sonder in London. And Sonder is you know, Bangladeshi housewives sort of people through an interfaith center there. And it really seemed to work quite well for them as well, even though I didn't get as much material to be able to analyze it properly. So especially chaplains have expressed a lot of interest in this in the UK. It's a little bit difficult for me because I'm still writing up a PhD. Yeah, so I'm not at the stage where you go out to the world and publicize it, you know, right? But the idea is eventually that the Subject Center makes this available for free, for downloading for free from their website. So it's good. The idea is to spread it indeed. Now, as far as the interfaith dialogue movement is concerned, actually I'm not as pessimistic as perhaps sounded in the beginning, because the people, the pluralist agenda, I think, they're sort of fading out just by irrelevance, it seems to me. Yeah, John Hick, for instance, Paul Mitter, these people in the UK, they all seem to be past their standby date. And I was even asked the question, you know, why do you even bother with these people, you know, anymore? And I think what's happening is the interfaith dialogue, its role changed in society in the way the role of religion changed in society. If you look at the UK now, religion really, it seems to me, has 3 main functions. One is welfare, one is community work, and one is as a moral authority. So like the legislation is passed, everyone runs to the Archbishop of Canterbury and asks him, do you go? At other times, everyone claims that only 10% really go to churches anymore. But still, it's a moral authority the Anglican Church is still there. So, and I think I see this reflected in the Interfaith Dialogue movement as well. You get projects, you know, say on the welfare level, where they really work on sort of global issues, world poverty, climate change, action-centered stuff that doesn't really care about truths all that much. Then you have community cohesion projects, the community work, that are also funded in the UK, and you know, and they might be able to do quite some good work. Maybe it's a little early to judge yet. And then you have the global ethic idea of Hans Küng, yeah, which represents the moral sort of authority idea, which I'm not as doubtful about as, for instance, about ideas of religious pluralism as for traditional. I'm not sure what's going to happen with these, you know, World Council of Churches. I mean, that's an institutional thing also, or Temple of Understanding, and world this and world that. But it seems to me they kind of like lose relevance.
Any other questions?
Thank you. Sorry, but I'll be down. That talked too long ago.